Hey, Blenders, on this week's show, Joker 2 reviews, and Francis Ford Coppola joins us to discuss his career.
This October, Tanger invites you to shop pink and save lives. Your donation of $10 or more to the Breast Cancer Research Foundation helps fuel innovative research that brings us closer to a cure. It also unlocks exclusive savings from brands like Coach, Crocs, Columbia Factory Store, and more to shop all month long. Join us as we mark 30 years of advancing research and empowering hope. Donate and access your exclusive savings today at Tanger.com.
Blenders, and welcome to episode number 324 of Real Blend, a podcast that will make you an offer for an interview you can't refuse. No, I'm not going to do an impersonation. Can't do Brando. It's too much. But on this week's show, Joker 2 reviews, Francis Ford Coppola joins the show to discuss his career and his new film Megalopolis, which we are also going to discuss in depth. I know we got Kevin's opinion on it. Gabe went to go see it. Jake went to go see it. Sean stayed home. Hi, guys. How are you? Welcome to the show.
Hey, buddy.
Hello.
Guys doing okay?
Hey, we got FCC on the show today.
I know. And we were talking before the show started.
Wait, scratch that.
What?
FFC. FFC.
Who's FCC?
The FCC is the person that makes sure that I don't swear on television every day.
I do want to share real briefly. We've had an incredible run of guests, but right before we recorded this, we did a really special one. For me personally, we got Andrew Garfield come on the show. It definitely happened. He's joined by John Crowley talking about We Live in Time, and I got to speak to him about Spider-Man, and that's all I really care about. So I'm going to mail this show in. And it's just completely just zone out
for the course.
Think about speaking with Andrew, and God, he talks so much about Tick, Tick, Boom too, which I love. That movie is so phenomenal.
Well, all right, don't give away all the goods. It's not coming out for like 2 more weeks.
Damn it! Can we run it this week? Can we bump Francis?
Right. Sorry, Francis. We're out of time.
Matt Damon. Yeah, sorry, Matt Damon. We ran out of time. Yeah, we got a bunch of really great interviews coming up, including on this week's show, Francis Ford Coppola. Hopefully earlier this week, you guys got a chance to listen to our own Kevin McCarthy speak to Kevin Smith on behalf of his new film, The 430 Movie. Gabe, what else should we plug? What else have we had on recently?
Recently? Oh, gosh. Let me take a look. We have a Get Tomorrow, hashtag if it happens, which should be fun.
Oh, yeah.
We have the directors for a really great Christopher Reeves documentary.
Yes. Fantastic.
Coming up next week. Jason Reitman was on the show to talk Saturday night. James McAvoy a few weeks ago.
Oh, God, McAvoy was great.
McAvoy
well,
was really
listen,
great.
None of this is possible unless you guys listen to the show and support us. So thank you so much for tuning in week after week. If you're on the YouTube channel, please hit subscribe, turn on your notifications, share the show with a friend. We really appreciate it. We're at youtube.com/RealBlendPodcast, the visual element of the show. Gabe and I are actually putting together something really fun for October, potentially. We'll talk about that when we're able to. Yeah. Jake, I'll clue you in on that. Yeah, no, I know.
Jake could join us if he wants.
I'm busy that day.
Welcome to join us.
Well, it's a week, so you could pick a day that week.
I got a thing.
You always have a thing. That's true. have I told you guys about Real Blend Premium? Real Blend Premium gets you an ad-free version of the show. This week, in particular, you'll have a newsletter from me in your inbox. So check the description for how you can sign up for Real Blend Premium and get an ad-free version of the show and that newsletter that I talked about. So, a lot of stuff going on. Starting with the fact that, so, get a little behind the scenes on Francis Ford Coppola. The man's an icon. He marches to his own drum. His schedule is, I think, constantly up in the air. But we were told a while ago there was an outside chance that we might be able to get him for the show. And I don't know about you guys, but I probably put it at like a 3. I was like, that's like a 3 out of 10, you know, a chance that it's going to happen. I'm saying,
yeah,
yeah, likelihood. Yeah. No, not quality. likelihood.
Like, you were like,
he's like a 3.
A legend. Yeah.
If we have time. So when it came together, it was really scary. That was really I was nervous for that one in a way that I haven't been nervous for an episode. But it was like, trying to prepare for it. And Jake, you had a lot more time. when you were going to get him in Toronto, you knew well in advance, you had time to do like a deep dive into his filmography. You started watching, you know, a bunch of his old films.
Not as much as you would think. I booked him in person for an in-person interview on a Wednesday. And my interview with him was going to be that following Monday. So less than a week. I had less than a week's notice. I just jumped into as much of a deep dive as I could.
Did you watch like something every night kind of thing?
Yeah. And they also had I cleared my schedule that weekend. There's nothing like there's nothing like canceling a date and telling her you have to watch The Conversation. I haven't heard back from her.
I was saying, at least it wasn't The Godfather, because that just sounds so cliche. Like, I gotta watch The Godfather.
Sorry, babe. You gotta watch The Godfather.
You didn't want to invite her over for the romantic film that is The Conversation?
There's nothing like middle of the date telling your date to shush so you can scribble down notes.
Gene Hackman is listening.
The best part is she doesn't even know what he does for a living. He's just scribbling notes while he's watching an old movie. He's confused.
I guarantee she doesn't know what The Conversation is either. So.
No.
Jake's like, I gotta watch The Conversation. She's like, between who?
Yeah.
Sorry.
That was good, man.
Oh, God. How are you not telling all your friends about this show? Honestly.
We're giving you our A game.
This is all, I told you I was mailing it in. I already talked to Andrew today. I don't need to do anything else. No, I do need to. What I need to do is throw it to Francis Ford Coppola. Francis Ford Coppola joining the Real Blend podcast on behalf of his brand new film, Megalopolis. We will talk about that film on the other side. Game on. Mr. Coppola, how are you, sir?
Call me Francis.
You got it. Francis, right. Thank you for joining the Real Blend podcast. My name is Sean. That's Jake and Kevin. I would like to start with a personal angle for myself. I was born in 1974.
Wow.
I turned 50 this year. I have long since argued. Thank you so much. The 1974 is the greatest year for cinema based on the sheer number of masterpieces that were released that year. Chinatown, A Woman Under the Influence, Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore. You managed to put out two masterpieces in 1 year, which is staggering in The Conversation. And of course, The Godfather Part Two. I'm curious if you could just tell me the difference between the film industry back then and the studio system in 1974 that allows you to release two films of that magnitude. And yet a movie like Megalopolis takes 4 decades to come together.
Well, you know, first of all, one of the mistakes, and I don't mean to correct someone, is that, you know, there have been 1,000 masterpieces. There was a period in the beginning of the movie industry with greats like Murnau and Lubitsch. I mean, it's happened before. It wasn't sure. Just the 70s, and it was really great. And so the conditions... George Lucas once made a very good quote that I was impressed. I heard he said, "Well, making a movie, you do the best you can given the conditions." But that word, "given the conditions," is very different from year to year to year. And in the 70s, when we were making those films, was a time when some giant types of movies like The Sound of Music and West Side Story. Was in the past, and they didn't quite know which way to go. And during that period of not knowing which way to go, there were these people like Billy Friedkin, myself, and some of the real greats that were a little younger, George Lucas, Martin Scorsese, Paul Schrader, Brian De Palma. I don't want to leave anyone out, but you know what I'm talking about. And they just took advantage of, quote, the conditions at that moment, which is the studios were going through change. There were different people coming in, people going out, and a lot of the we as me and my colleagues just jumped in and took advantage of that moment. And then, you know, then things changed. And later on, there were films like Heaven's Gate, which ended up not. You know, whenever you do something new, you're in danger of it doesn't do well right away. And then they closed the gate real fast and they blamed it on Heaven's Gate. It wasn't Heaven's Gate's fault. In fact, Heaven's Gate is well thought of today. Hmm. But this has happened all around the world. I mean, the person who did most like what I did, which is just make a movie and say, what the hell? I mean, I'll just borrow the money, was Jacques Tati in France. He made those beautiful movies, Mon Oncle and Mr. Hulot, what have you, and were very popular, made a lot of money, and took all of his money, everything he had, because he wanted to make a film that no one would quite let him make the way he wanted to make, and he made it, and it was a big flop. And he lived, Jacques Tati, he lived in poverty. People would let him come over and stay at their house because they loved him and everything, and he died. And that movie he made was Playtime, which was a great, great, great masterpiece. And you know, I felt, my God, I ought to get on my knees and say, thank you, Jacques Tati, for making something that made me laugh and in such a wonderful way and understand modern times better than anyone ever did. So, you know, our history is full of that stuff all over the world. I mean, in France, the opera Carmen was so booed that its composer, who had a bad heart, was only 50, was your age, died, and never knew that his opera was beloved. You know, so when you do something new, you have to be willing to accept that a lot of people don't like what they don't know about. But after a while, they see it. Like the Eiffel Tower, they hated the Eiffel Tower. They said, tear that down. But if you tore the Eiffel Tower down now, they'd kill you. So
yeah, yeah.
You know, I don't know the answer.
Yeah, interesting. Thank you.
Francis, the moment I saw Megalopolis here in Chicago, I instantly knew, oh, this is a movie people need to see on an IMAX screen as big as humanly possible. I know you attempted to work with IMAX decades ago on Apocalypse Now, and you really wanted to use their cameras for that. But I want you to think your entire filmography, all of your films, what is one moment, one scene, one sequence you most wish audiences could have experienced on an IMAX screen outside of Megalopolis?
Gee, that's an interesting question. Let me think. I would say it would probably be something from Apocalypse Now, and it probably might be that incredible shot Vittorio Storaro designed, where you come in and you come in with them and you see all those guys painted white in almost naked. Those, by the way, those people who did that were real Stone Age people. They were not extras. They were Ifugao, what we call the Ifugao. And I remember once those people, they were living there, and there was, you know, they didn't know the Filipino people too well. And there was a point where someone insulted someone, and I never saw human men get up trees so fast in my life, because they were ready to kill. And they could get up those palm trees in 2 seconds. And then from that position, of course, they dominated. But that was something I remember. It was extraordinary. They were wonderful people. They were always laughing. No one knew whose kids anyone was, because they took care of all the kids. All the kids were their kids. Anyway, sorry, that's not what you.
No, asked. That would be a great. His arrival, Martin Sheen's arrival, would be an incredible. I honestly thought you were going to say Ride of the Valkyrie. So that's really interesting.
Well, you know whose idea was to do the Ride of the Valkyrie? It wasn't mine. Now, people think because my family was classical musicians that I had that idea. That was John Milius' idea.
Oh, wow.
That's cool.
One thing I do that's honest is you can ask me anything in any of my films that was good, and I'll tell you who really thought of it.
That's awesome. Often in Hollywood.
Yeah. I one thing I find really interesting about you as a filmmaker and just directors in general, there must be a very emotional moment when you finally hear the score that's going to be used for your movies. And you've been making movies for over 60 years, and you've had a lot of composers compose a lot of great themes for your films. And I was wondering if you could just walk through the process, maybe even starting at Godfather, because Godfather, the theme in that film is one of the most iconic pieces of music of all time.
But that theme that you're talking about was the last one that we arrived at. That was the problem theme. Now, the reason I chose Nino Rota to do the Godfather music wasn't, although he made these white, wonderful Fellini scores, it was the score he did for Rocco and His Brothers Rocco and His Brothers by, his, anyway, that score I thought was The Godfather. That's what made me feel it. But with this love song, you know, I wanted it to be a little African because Sicily is right next to Africa, and I wanted a little of the Arabic intervals, you know, that kind of da 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 da. And we could never come up with a song that would do it. And when I left, and he wrote the score. And when I came back, Nino Rota met me at the airport, and he walked, and as we were walking down the airport, he said, "Francis, I think I have a idea for the song that we didn't, that, you know, because we were going to record it, and he wanted me to hear it right away." And he said, "Da da 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 dee da 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 da." And I said, "That's good. That sounds Arabic, you know." And actually, what he had taken is from another movie that he had made. There was a fast dance that went da 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 da, and he slowed it down. And so when it came, got nominated for best score, the musicians group that controls the Academy says the rule is it has to be written originally for the movie. And so they disqualified the Godfather score because he had used the theme from another movie. But basically, you know, a lot of times the Hollywood groups like that didn't do it themselves. It's a problem of what we call not invented here, you know, like when my son did the special effects on Dracula, they all wanted it to be digital effects, which was a new thing then. And I said, "I'm not doing it." And I basically, you know, in the movie business, you sort of have to, the only way you can emphatically not stop what they're doing if you don't like it is to fire them. So I fired all the special effects people, and I did all the, and you know, when Dracula came up, it didn't even get the hint of a nomination for special effects.
Come on. And his shadow, when he's going to choke him, that is unbelievable.
That's the way, don't forget the various trade unions and guilds control the nomination process. So the musicians, they were annoyed because Bob Evans was going to have, I don't know, Johnny Green write the music. And then I ended up with Nino Rota, and Evans tried to take the music out of the picture completely. Oh, and there was a period of 2 weeks when I didn't know if we were going to keep the music. So this is the stuff of movie history. You know, sometimes this great things were not what they wanted.
Francis. Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah. Keep going, please.
No, I'll shut up.
This is a topic of conversation that we love having on this show. It thrills me to no end that we're able to speak to you for a new film for Megalopolis that contemporaries of yours, Mr. Scorsese, as in putting out Killers of the Flower Moon, films like Silence, Steven Spielberg doing The Fablemans, something that's so incredibly personal to him. We've had the filmmaker Quentin Tarantino on our show often. He comes back on and he is claiming he's going to direct a 10th movie and be finished. He doesn't believe the filmmakers should keep going. If I did the math correctly, I believe that your 11th feature would have been Apocalypse Now, and you had stopped at 10. We wouldn't have The Outsiders or Cotton Club or Peggy Sue or Dracula
or Rumblefish.
Rumblefish. Yes. Rumblefish.
So I want to hear.
Rumblefish was a big flop, but it inspired a lot of young people to be movie directors, which is the greatest award you can get.
Well, and I can't tell. I mean, The Outsiders is everything to me. It's a movie that was influential to me in my youth. So what is your reaction when you hear that an artist, any artist, whether it be a filmmaker or someone, that they want to stop at a certain point so as to preserve the integrity of what they're putting out?
Well, you never know if it's true. I mean, I'm sure if Quentin does that, he's such a talented person that if something happens to him in 2 years and he just has the urge to make it as a film, he will. Mm-hmm. I mean, making a film, it's hard to make a film. Your life is in, and I don't know, to preserve your legacy. I don't care about my legacy. You know, your legacy is like the weather. In 5 years from now, it'll be, who is Francis Coppola? I never heard of him. Oh, yeah, he made that. I didn't like that. And then years later, the weather clears up. Oh, there was this great guy, Francis Coppola. He's been forgotten. And then, oh, no, I knew he was there. It's not important. What's important, the greatest award you can get comes from time. And it happened to me recently. Did you see All Quiet on the Western Front by Edward? Mm-hmm. He asked if he could meet me, and I hadn't seen the film, but they said, oh, he's a wonderful filmmaker. And he came, and I shook his hand. He was not a kid, but he was, you know, a very, very gracious. And he said, I became a filmmaker because I saw Apocalypse Now. Mm. Wow. And that, to me, is better than $1 million check or $1 trillion check. That's saying that I'm part of the film industry, and that's all I really want. I want to be one of the group. I don't want to be the best. I don't want to be the worst, but I just want to be part of it. That's all. And then when a young person, as many Latin American novelists and filmmakers told me that they saw that for some reason Rumblefish in Chile got held over for a year and they all saw it, that to me is that's the prize.
That's awesome.
To be part of that contingent, just like a human being. I mean, to be part of the human species and have grandchildren or children and coming from your grandfather, and, you know, to be part of that wonderful process, is, that's a joy. I'm a great grandfather now.
Oh, congratulations. That's fantastic.
Francis, I'm a big believer that I think that hardships can be incredibly valuable in life, because you get through them and then you can look back and go, well, if I survived that, I can survive anything. I recently rewatched Heart of Darkness, which just is a testament. One, it's a brilliant, brilliant film, but it's also a testament of everything you were able to overcome on the set of Apocalypse Now. And I was wondering if there were moments after that, and even on Megalopolis, where you're having a bad day, things are not going as well as you thought, that it's a disaster in some form or fashion, and you're able to use that experience and go, listen, I survived that. I can survive anything.
Well, I can give you an experience that was like that, but I don't know that I made anything good out of it. But it was, you know, really made me wonder what my life was, whether my life was just all these movies I was making, or I had, or was it something more mysterious I understand? Is when I made a film that's not very well known. It was called Gardens of Stone, and the story was about a man who loses this young soldier that he sort of mentored and was like his son, and I really lost my son on it, and that's what made me say is I know that I was like Michael Corleone when I made The Godfather, because I had no power and I had to be a Machiavellian type, so everyone's always Michael Cole. And then on Apocalypse, well, you described, I had to be like a megalomaniac, so I was like Kurtz. But to make Garden of Stone, did I have to lose my son? Mm. You know, apparently I did, but I, you know, that when you lose a child, that's a 30-year sentence. For 30 years, you wake up and it's, did it happen? And it's the first thing you think of for 30 years. And it was that way for me. But I don't understand is my life that I am really condemned to be living a movie that I'm making? It's all as though I say it jokingly, but it's all as though my life was written by Charlie Kaufman. You know?
You know, Francis, one of the things I find really interesting about film, and you were talking earlier about how things that are classic may not have been known they were going to be classic at the time, because they, you know, the film history and everything kind of, you know, leads on. But there are moments in your movies, and this might be a very particular thing to bring up, but I've always found it interesting, and I've always been curious if you knew on the day when you shot this scene in The Godfather, when you go from Brando's mustache to that tree, and it's like this dissolve. And I'm just wondering, like, that moment I've always found fascinating is visually. And I'm curious, when you have moments like that in your films, did you know you were going to do that before the editing room? And like, are there other moments like that in your career that have been like more happy accidents in your films?
Yeah, no, it's everything, every possibility. In that case, I didn't know. And that maybe was something that the editor found interesting, or someone else said, you know, film is a collaboration. And a lot of great things that happen in your films is not because you did it, unfortunately. You know, the great line that Clemenza says, you know, leave the gun, take the cannoli. He made that line up. I did the part where his wife says, bring home a cannoli. So there wouldn't have been a cannoli without me. But he said that line.
Wow.
You know, I didn't, it wasn't my idea. And there are a lot of great things in the movie that, you know, I was presiding over it, and I chose the people who made the movie, but a lot of the great ideas were not mine. I mean, I hate to admit it, but you must have guessed that by now.
Well, and to come back around to Megalopolis, Francis, you have, yeah, have treated these movies, certain movies in your past, as living documents. You like to go back to them. You like to tinker with them. So how did you know when this one was finished and ready for release?
I knew it was finished when I started writing another script for a different movie that I wanted to make next.
Oh, okay. So that's the defining point.
Yeah. I knew that Megalopolis was, you know, sort of like Apocalypse Now, in that there aren't a lot of films like it. Mm-hmm. And when you do something new, you get all kinds of reactions. You know, you get people who hate it, people who love it, and it really takes time. Apocalypse Now came out, and, you know, as you know, I mean, the big hot picture at that time was the Kramer versus Kramer, and Apocalypse didn't get any attention and didn't really open well. But the thing about Apocalypse Now is people kept going back to see it. And even with Megalopolis, one thing I hear is, wow, it was, I have to see it again.
Yeah.
I don't think it's boring, so people don't mind. It's only 2 hours and 13 minutes. But when you see it again, have you seen it? You've seen it once, or you haven't?
Once. Just once.
Yeah.
And seeing it a second time, it plays differently. Even for me, when I saw it in New York two nights ago in IMAX, it played differently than I've ever seen. I never saw it completely on IMAX from beginning to end before, and in a good seat, because they had me hidden the first time I saw it. And I really got a lot more out of it on this viewing. So, you know, I mean, I think that what's going to happen with Apocalypse Now is what happened with Megalopolis, is that it's going to be seen and people are going to, you know, movies are illusions. So if you go into a movie thinking it's going to be in the key of G minor, because that's what most movies are, and you get in there and it's really in B flat, the whole thing doesn't work for you. And when a movie doesn't work, the acting is bad. In other words, I it's something you don't know. I'll tell you a story. When I when Godfather 2, which had this unusual structure of being both a prequel and a sequel intercut with each other, when we were ready to open it in New York, 6 weeks before it opened, we previewed it in San Francisco. And the audience hated it. They hated it. They hated the acting. They said, how come these great actors are so terrible? And blah, 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 blah. I was so depressed. I spent that night under the bed of my house because everyone was looking at what I felt about this terrible reaction. But under the bed, I realized what I had done wrong, that the prequel, sequel were sort of 10 minutes of this, 10 minutes of that. And it wasn't long enough. We were yanking the audience out of the story before they were ready. And so to do it, to make them 20 minutes would be 129 picture changes, which the editors stayed up all night and were able to do, which was very hard because it was a finished mixed movie. And we previewed it then 2 days later in San Diego, or 4 days later. And it was night and day. They loved it, and they loved the acting. So I was very impressed with how can you hate the actors and love the actors, and it's exactly the same performance. Because if the illusion isn't working for you, then you don't like anything because it's just a lot of pictures on a screen. And you know what I'm saying? So then we went and brought it to New York. And of course, it was a big success. And Woodward. And I learned then that, you know, that audiences sort of have a combination lock number. You have to know it so that sometimes there's something you can do about it. But with Apocalypse Now, we cut it down, made it short, cut the French plantation out. Nothing we did made the movie work better, except it was shorter. But then 5 years later, people had seen it more and more, and they started to like it. And in those days, you know who owns Apocalypse Now? Do you know?
No.
I do, and you know why? No one wanted it. And so I borrowed the money in interest with 21% interest. And I was sure that I was going to get wiped out and lose everything. And I was worried for my wife, who was always so courageous in letting me do these things. But people never stopped going to see about it. To this day, they're still seeing it in large, making large numbers for 50, 40 years. So I believe that Megalopolis is the same kind of thing where it's not a movie you can easily say, well, I know what that, I've seen a movie like that, so I sort of know what it is. And then you get people who are saying about the picture, oh, it's wonderful, it's terrific, but you're saying, people are saying it's terrible, I hate it. So, you know, the thing is that they're going to just keep going back and seeing it and see, I think, I don't know, you tell me.
Yeah, now that's what we want, is conversation starters, that we all go to the movies to start conversations.
But it's true that there isn't a movie you could say Megalopolis is like. What movie is it like?
Nothing.
Nothing.
Yeah.
Nothing.
So that means you're out on your own, and it has to earn an audience to be willing to see it on its own terms. And that's hard to find today, because we live in a time, you know, where, as you know, two wonderful institutions are dying around us. One is journalism, because of the reality of journalism. So now you're getting articles of unknown sources and clickbait and stuff like that. And the studio system is dying at the same time. Now, something will replace both of those things, because we love journalism and we love what the studio system wasn't just Hollywood and Warner's and Zanuck and Goldwyn and that. It was also UPP and those fantastic films they made in Germany with Murnau and Fritz Lang and Lubitsch and all the Hungarians, Korda. And it's a world phenomenon and all around us, journalism is dying, but will be reborn, I hope, and I'm sure. And the studio movie system, you know, like companies like take Warner Brothers, which made the two Godfathers. When I made big successes for them and we won a lot of Oscars, but when I said, will you please finance Apocalypse Now? They said no.
Wow.
Wow.
And imagine if they said no, and I was so hot as a young guy who had, as you said, you know, two big things. What would they say to an 85-year-old grandpa who wants to make a nutty movie like, of course it was no.
Oh, sure. Right, yeah.
And they have to, because these companies have been bought so many times that the big job of any studio head is to make its debt payments, because there's a lot of debt on all the companies. And they're paid a lot of money, but if they miss their debt payments, they get fired.
Well, we thank you for continuing to bring things to theaters as much as possible.
Well, I love the theater experience, of course. There's nothing as thrilling as I remember going to see Lawrence of Arabia in a theater. I never will forget it. Can you, or Dr. Strangelove.
Yeah.
Oh,
you know, oh. I mean, these impressions, I mean, you can enjoy a movie a great movie. I saw recently Renoir's French Can-Can. I saw it at home. It was great. Have you ever seen French Can-Can?
No, I have not.
Renoir. I met him. I met John Renoir. He was a very sweet man. It's so great to meet some of these geniuses. You know, I met Kurosawa. He was
What? God. You met Kurosawa? Do you remember the meeting? I'm sorry.
We helped him because he got fired from a Fox picture called Tora, Tora, Tora. They had hired a Japanese director and Richard Fleischer to direct this movie about the Japanese invasion. They fired Kurosawa and he was very depressed. And George Lucas and I got Paramount to finance his Kagamusha movie. And we met him. He was a wonderful man.
Oh, my God. That's incredible.
Well, this is a story that we're going to tell like that, meeting you.
I guess. I mean, that's part of what it's about. And then someone's going to meet one of you or all of you. And the same thing, you know, we're all part of it. And you know, one thing Megalopolis says, which is the truth, is that our species is a species of geniuses. You can't deny it. You know, when I say that, you know what people argue with after I say that? And they say, yeah, but we can do bad things with that genius. I said, well, what is that? That's not the argument. The argument of why we do bad things with the genius is a different discussion. But do you acknowledge that we're a family of one family of geniuses? And I said, well, I never thought of it.
They will now.
Because if we're a family of geniuses, then our children are valuable because they're going to be geniuses. And it means more important that there's no problem we are facing with the climate or with society or with all these bad, idiotic things going on that we can't come up with a solution. That's the important thing, that the problems of today are unnecessary.
Right.
That's a terrible thing to say. I mean, if they were necessary, you say, well, we'll figure out how to get through it. But they're not even necessary.
Right. So no, anyway. It's true. It's fabricated.
Do any of you have children?
I have two boys.
Well, I mean, you want the world to be wonderful for them, right?
You know, it's just today I had both of them checking in with me. Well, they're 16 and 20.
Well, they're you're going to have grandchildren before you know it.
Francis, let's settle down. Please. Not just yet. But the 20-year-old was getting dressed up in his first suit. He is putting on his first suit to go to a job fair. And he hung up and just said, thanks, Dad, I love you, as he headed out the door. And I hung up the phone with him and I legitimately started tearing up because I'm watching this man, a grown man now, you know, leave. And it's a milestone for him and I'm proud, but he'll always be, you know, he'll always be your baby. So,
but you want there to be a beautiful future for the next generation.
For sure.
Yep.
For sure. Yep. Yeah.
Me too.
We're getting
thrown
out.
Thank you guys. That's all on stop time now. Time. Yeah. Okay.
this was a dream come true, Francis. We really appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
We would like to thank the legend that is Francis Ford Coppola for making the time to talk about the Real Blend podcast. You know, what I was trying to set up is getting ready to speak to him, how nervous I was, because where do you even begin to scratch the surface of his filmography? How do you even prepare? How do you even, like, it'd be tough to come up with five questions, you know, that he hasn't been asked about one of his films, you know, let alone all of them, kind of thing. My takeaway from that conversation, Jake, and I'm wondering if you feel the same way, is that he couldn't have been easier to talk to. Like, he couldn't have been, it was like just plugging in with someone who has just this infinite passion for cinema, you know, and for filmmaking, and probably has, we make this joke a lot between us that, like, we've been lucky enough to do more things than we could ever, you know, remember. And to the point where, like, people will bring up an experience and we'll go like, oh my, yeah, I actually forgot that I did that. Francis Ford Coppola has that times 1,000, you know, like, he must have more stories from Apocalypse Now than we would ever dream of our lives. And so to get him to just be able to start to open up and tell these incredible memories and this, you know, his experiences was phenomenal. And in the middle of that interview, in a way that I think I rarely have felt while doing Real Blend, I was struck by, holy shit, we're talking to Francis Ford Coppola.
Yeah.
Like, that was my takeaway in the middle of it, of just like, stop what you're doing and process the fact that Francis Ford Coppola is on this show that we created. I'm assuming you had similar takeaways.
Yeah. And there's something that happened with us that also happened,
with me whenever I was with him. And so I, for people that don't know, I was able to speak with him in person in Toronto a few weeks prior to us having him on Real Blend.
You'll probably get an Emmy nomination for that one, too.
I would assume. You know, we'll see. We'll see. You know how these things are.
For people who don't know, Jake got an Emmy nomination for his conversation with Martin Scorsese. So
well earned.
Jake's having a good year.
Thank you. It's a good run.
The Coppola package is very good. I recommend it.
Thank you very much.
And I would not be surprised if you were nominated for it, sir.
It would be, you know, okay. So here's what I want to say. That the Coppola piece that I crafted for my station, I specifically started with him saying, which he said to us as well, call me Francis.
Yeah.
And I felt like I wanted to start out the story with that, because to me, I find that so fascinating. And yeah, that is such a very human, a human moment shouldn't always be applauded, because, like, you know what? He's a human being. We're human beings. We deserve to be treated like human beings.
Sure.
But to me, that's such a almost like a legend breaking, like it just kind of cracks open the doors, like the gates of Jurassic Park, where it just sort of opens this person.
Yeah.
And to me, that's the moment where it stops becoming the legend of Francis Ford Coppola and becomes a guy.
Yeah, you know? Just a guy. Yeah.
But it's such a tightrope. And I'm curious if you guys felt the same way, because you want to respect why we're there, right? Like, he's giving us the reason we're being given time is because he has a new movie coming out called Megalopolis. Mm-hmm. And so out of respect for that, you want to make sure we talk about that.
Sure. Yeah.
But I've been equating talking to like a Francis Ford Coppola or you know, you get a Scorsese or a Spielberg, whatever the case may be, to like going to a Rolling Stones concert. Mm. I get that you have a new album out, and that's great. And if you want to play a couple of songs, sure. But like, you better play Gimme Shelter. You better play Sympathy for the Dead. Like, there are certain things you're going to need to hear him say, or it's going to be, I mean, I was, I got about 10 minutes with him in Toronto. And I asked my first question, and if you couldn't tell from that interview, he's a long talker. Now here's the thing. Everything he says is fascinating. The man has more than half a century of experience in this industry. He's never said anything boring. But about 2 minutes into my interview with him, when it's all Megalopolis stuff, there was a part of me that, because I flew myself to Toronto for that interview, there was a part of me that was like, did I fly myself to Toronto to get 10 minutes on Megalopolis? Like, just say Godfather, man. Just say the words Godfather.
And I think we've talked about this on the show before. I always secretly curse you that you get these people and they only talk about their worst movies.
Well, my and it's happened a couple of times. The Spielberg or the Scorsese interview, which he was great. When I got Scorsese last year, he was fantastic. But I asked a question I was very excited about, which was, speaking of Andrew Garfield, which was which character's soul are you most worried about? Yeah. And, you know, your mind goes to all the greatest hits, right? You go to Travis Bickle, you go to, you know, yeah, Jake LaMotta, Henry Hill.
Yeah.
and he brought up Silence, which is like probably his favorite movie he's ever directed. And like, it's his passion project and like it's his baby. But again, when you're hoping for Gimme Shelter and you get the new album. Or what was the other one, Sean? I asked Jodie Foster like a giant legacy question, which could have yielded like a really great answer about anything from her career. And her answer was Nell.
Yeah. And I said to you right before
you said you're going
to
get Nell.
I hope she only talks to you about Nell. I just want her to
and she did. I so badly wanted to be sure. I wanted her to tell a story about being, because, you know, you kind of ask a question, you sort of reverse engineer. You're like, well, I really wanted to talk about role X. So like, well, how can I get, what can I ask to get her there? So I really wanted, anyway, I got
it. But it turned out well enough. You enjoyed that experience.
But Coppola, but I mean, but I that was a long way of saying, I really feel like our interview on the show was just an incredible collection of greatest hits. It was a greatest hits album.
One thing I talked to Sean about, I think right afterwards, was, and it's always the best, because anytime you ask someone a question about a movie that they're not promoting, there's always a little bit of, you got to be careful, you got to be respectful, and you got to hope that they're willing to play along and are not going to take it personally, or, you know, you don't want to be the guy that asks the well, sort of question.
You kind of have to earn it.
To quote James McAvoy from our own show.
Yeah, they can promote their own fucking movie. Yeah,
exactly. Yes.
I felt like he, more often than not, the best thing that happens is when they say, when I made such and such, and then they start talking about that movie, and it kind of, they open the door and want to talk about that. I feel like he did that quite a few times.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And was willing to sort of dip into the well, which is a gift, I think.
All right. You guys both have seen Megalopolis. Kevin tried to review it last week, had a tough time conveying what he didn't like about it. Just seemed frustrated by it, seemed kind of aggravated by it. You know, it didn't work for him in any way, shape or form. Gabe, I a little bit want to start with you. You just saw it and briefly in the text thread seemed to make it seem like you had a different reaction to it.
Yeah, I think I didn't go into it expecting not to like it. Like, I think I went in fairly blank slate, but I knew the conversation around it. So I was expecting it to be weird. I was expecting it to be different. And I wasn't expecting to love everything about it or even understand it.
The conversation is harsh on it. Like,
I think it's too harsh. I think that's kind of what I was getting at in the, I mean, I understand it. Let me put it that way.
Okay.
I think that there's a lot more to enjoy in it than I was expecting, given the conversation. Mm-hmm. There's a lot more humor in it. I can tell from, like, I saw it with a just a normal audience at a normal screening last night. And there are times where people are laughing at the movie that is because it's kind of weird and ridiculous.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe the movie's not asking for a laugh there. But there are times where the movie definitely knows that this is silly and funny and is being silly and funny. And those get laughs, and that's it working. And I think that it's not really taking itself as seriously as maybe the trailer might sell it.
Okay.
Or as people are maybe thinking it is, because it's the guy that made The Godfather. I think that what he's trying to say in the movie is clear. I was worried that it was going to be incoherent. That was one of my worries. Mm. But it was. And I think that if you're someone who wants to be a part of the conversation or wants to sort of complete that lexicon of what cinema has to offer and what's been done, I think whatever Francis Ford Coppola does, you owe it to yourself to see what he's doing.
Sure.
But I think that he tries so many new things, whether they work for you or not, good or bad, remains to be seen. I think you owe it to yourself to experience that and to know that that's what a master of this, a guy that doesn't need to prove anything to anyone, is putting forward. I think that has worth. There was a
comment that I want to ask you about, though, specifically.
Sure.
I've seen people really critique the editing as being choppy, sloppy, kind of bad. Did that strike you?
That's kind of what I think. There are moments here that I'd be curious to hear him talk more about it, because there are sometimes there are moments where, is this Francis Ford Coppola? Because you know how sometimes, I'll put it this way, you know how sometimes Scorsese just doesn't care about continuity. He's kind of famous for, like, he wants to put the best take forward, the best thing. And when he's telling you a great story, you don't really notice it. But it's technically a flub. There are moments that there's very obvious continuity differences. Okay. There's a moment where they're cutting back and forth in the middle of a conversation, and Adam Driver's character has two different newspapers with two different, completely very different. One looks like a traditional newspaper. Another one has a big image and, like, red on it. And each time it cuts, it's different. And I'm not trying to say, like, hey, man, you just don't get it, because I don't know that I get it. And I'm not trying to put it out there of, like, yeah, it's way ahead of its time. I don't know.
I
don't necessarily understand everything about this movie. But I think he's trying something there. Like, I think that that is a deliberate choice.
Okay.
And there are choices that I think are really fascinating that I really enjoyed. There's moments that felt like it was right out of, like, a Marx Brothers film, like really funny bits of comedy and bits of performance that are, like, impressionistic in the way that a director might typically paint the frame with sort of props or settings or dressings, things that sort of tip you to, like, we're alluding towards this, you know, these characters have this relationship. And so we sort of dress the set to sort of give it that macabre feel if they're, you know, this, that, and the other.
Sure.
The performances themselves kind of lend them to that. I have a couple examples. Is there's a moment in the trailer where Adam Driver sits down next to his mother, and she says, you know, crocodiles had it right. They eat their young. And that's the first, that's how you were introduced to this person. And very quickly, Adam Driver is leaving the table. And there's this, like, impressionistic thing, almost like a interpretive dance moment of his performance, where he's, like, kind of like, ugh, but he ends with like kissing her head in a loving way. And okay. In 3 seconds, you understand that the relationship that these two people have.
Yeah.
After an hour and a half of watching this movie and never seeing this person, you understand the relationship, okay. Which I think is really great. There's a moment with Shia LaBeouf's character, who's kind of playing this sort of leader of this weird troupe. It's very like a Shakespearean sort of character. And there's a moment where he like hands his coat to his second in command. And this is sort of the Marx Brothers sort of thing. And he drops his hat on the ground. He says, pick up my hat. And then the second in command picks up the hat, throws his own hat down, tells third in command, pick up my hat. Then the third in command takes it, throws his hat down, tells the fourth guy, pick up my hat. And in half a second, you understand this sort of like this conversation that he is having about power and the lust for power and how whoever has power, there's someone below them that wants to feel powerful.
Yeah.
And he does that he throws that away. Like it just happens. And it's funny, but it's meaningful. And I think it's filled with really great moments. Mm. It is also filled with ridiculous things that I think, you know, one, I think the sort of internet age that we live in, when something can be sort of perceived as ridiculous, the conversation sort of takes it and people kind of come in with that, expecting that. And then it just sort of people have fun sort of making fun of something. There's plenty of this that I think is totally fair. And okay. I totally understand why someone would leave and be like, the memes that we've been sharing and talking about, I don't think are unwarranted, I guess is what I'm trying to say.
Right.
But I went in thinking like, man, I wonder if there's any reason to watch this or if I'm going to get anything out of it. And I got a lot more out of it than I was expecting, which made it more enjoyable. I'm curious how Jake, I haven't heard what Jake's thought, so I'm dying to know.
In the spirit of Megalopolis, I'm going to speak in a pretentious metaphor.
Exactly.
There's this thing this mistake that I've made a couple of times, and I'm sure you guys have done this or at least can relate to some degree. Do you ever, you know, you have an interview coming up, maybe it's like 3 or 4 weeks away and you get a screener for the movie. And so you watch the movie 3 or 4 weeks in advance of doing your interview and you scribble down all your notes, right? You got all your notes for all the interviews and you kind of put it aside and you go, say, okay, I'll come back to that when it gets closer. And then 3 or 4 weeks later, you pull your notes out and you look at them and you go, what the hell were all these about? Like, I know I watched the movie and I have some vague memory of writing these notes, but I have no recollection of what I intended to do with these things.
Right, right.
And I sort of feel like Coppola has been trying to make this thing for like 30 years, right? I feel like he has decades worth of notes that when it finally came time to call action, he looked back over decades of dusty notes and went, the hell was I going to do with all this? Okay, all right, that being said, I think it's a visually arresting piece of work that I never enjoyed watching, but never necessarily wanted it to end. I kept going, okay, like I don't like this, but keep going. Mm. Like, let me see what else you got. I do think every single actor was in a completely different movie. I don't think any of them ever really sat down collectively as a group and all agreed to come at this from the same place.
Right.
In a weird way, I actually feel like, Gabe, and I'm curious if you agree, I feel like of the entire cast, Shia best understood the assignment, as the kids say.
Yeah, and I think his character is just the most straight. Well, that's not fair to say the most straightforward. I think the parallels of his character to like the conversation around politics in our society right now and sort of all of that is very, I think, more obvious than everyone else. Yeah. And he gives a great performance. I mean, but it's kind of a traditional, like, it's a very large performance, which is not to say that's hard or easy. You know, I don't mean to disqualify it, but he gets a lot to chew with, you know, like lots to chew on with what he's given. But I agree. I think so.
I will say this, that when the movie ended, and Gabe, maybe I'll put the spoiler alert stamp on this. And Gabe, if you feel like this is cuttable, we can cut this part out. The end of the film in which this architect who really just wanted to craft a better world is left feeling very reflective. After fighting the politics of it and fighting the money side of it and kind of coming across all of these obstacles that he had to overcome in order to build this greater world, right? And he's left being very reflective and says something along the lines, Adam Driver does, I have so much left to say, but I don't know how much time I have left. And there's a there's a moment that indicates that his young daughter might just be as talented as he is. And then the movie ends. And so at that, even though I didn't necessarily enjoy the process of watching the movie, when it was over, I couldn't help but feel like this is a little bit of Coppola being just reflective about the process of who he is as a storyteller. The fact that he's an 85-year-old man who still has probably a dozen great movies in him, but is getting, as Scorsese is, very reflective about time. But is looks at his daughter, who is an incredibly talented and accomplished filmmaker in her own right, and maybe looks at her as, I may not have the time to tell all the great stories left in me, but they will be told in some form or fashion by the talent that my daughter has. And I choose to believe that that's so in a weird way, it made me like Megalopolis more, because I choose to believe that, like, in a weird way, Coppola is doing a lot of things here. But if this is also his weird sort of autobiographical epilogue, it kind of makes me dig it more.
I think a lot of it is that, and this, I like having this conversation, because I feel like you're highlighting things that I didn't notice, or, you know, making it more clear. Which surprises me.
Remember that? Because remember, it shows, like, it shows that the young daughter can do what Adam Driver does.
Does it show that?
Mm-hmm. That she can stop time.
The very okay. I remember this. I want to dive more into the ending with you. Sean hasn't seen it yet. But
No, it's okay. I apologize, Sean.
No, I don't. I don't think you're going to ruin this movie yet, to be honest with you.
That's fair. I think that it's yes, I think it's very much a reflection on that. I think he would say that it's not just about himself and his daughter. I think he's being, I think the conversation he's trying to have around it is largely like, we are all Adam Driver. We're all capable of being Adam Driver's character in this, of creating whatever it is in our world and in our life. And we can do that in a way that allows whatever comes next to pick up that mantle and continue.
Yeah.
But what's meaningful is not to build it, because whatever is built will fall, but it's the questions that you ask so that those questions remain in whoever is goes on. Like, I think that's a largely what he's talking about, which is kind of a beautiful sentiment. And it's done in a way that is totally weird. And
yes. And that's the thing. I'm not going to come on this show and try to pretend like I was just in awe of this theatrical experience that I had to be a part of. Like, a huge portion of my theatrical experience watching this was me going, the fuck am I watching?
It's what a movie that anytime I hear, like, from now forever, anytime I talk to someone who says they saw it, I want to know what they thought of it. Does that make sense?
I want to make one more quick compare, because I am, to your point, Sean, I'm getting just a little frustrated and annoyed at the joy that people are finding in ripping this movie apart in a similar way that I got very frustrated at the amount of people that found joy in Kevin Costner's failure with Horizon. Mm-hmm. Like, you have two really great filmmakers who are literally paying their own money to be able to bring their dream to the big screen.
Sure.
I don't understand why the failure of those movies is something to laugh at. Like, you should be cheering for those things. Yeah. You should be like, whether you like them or not, if you're a fan of the filmmaking process and of movie going. And if
the current conversation around movies is fundamentally broken.
Yeah, like, that's you're 100% right. You're 100% right.
Yeah. It's almost like people go into them more to lampoon what is being put forward. Whereas, not to get pretentious, but like back in the 70s when Coppola started, this was a revered art form.
Yeah.
And you would commend a director for making challenging things, for making big swings. And now it is almost like mainstream audiences want their stuff to be pre-chewed, you know, and fed to them that way.
It's also, I think, just like, it's a bit reductive. Like, people always say, like, we want original, because franchises are kind of running the gambit right now.
Sure.
But we know that that is not true, because when there is a good franchise movie, people enjoy it and they turn out for it. And people say, we want something original. Newsflash, spoiler, this movie is like nothing you have ever seen before.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean that it's good. It doesn't
There's
mean that you're going
to
like it.
There's literally a live human element to the movie.
Yes, but it is like nothing you have ever seen before. And it's getting sort of blasted in spite of that. And so I think that I think people's sort of perception of that is a bit reductive in thinking that it just needs to be original, yeah. versus as reductive as this is, it just yeah. needs to be good. Well, and I think that it's, to Jake's point, I think at some point you just have to admire that we get to experience this, that this much money was spent on this movie with complete creative control by someone who's been this influential in the art form. Regardless of what happens on screen, it's fascinating to see unfold.
Yeah. And I feel the same way about Horizon. And I think it's honestly a bit of a travesty that we might not get like the end of his, whether you liked it or not.
Yeah.
Like Kevin Costner's earned the right to be able to tell his dream story.
There's something. He cut himself off at the knees with that a little bit by announcing this is part one of four.
I don't disagree with, but I mean, you could tell by the end of part one.
That level of bravado, he invited himself to be kind of chastised.
Do you think that was a play for like, this is a franchise? Like trying to get ahead of it, of like, is an original Western going to get any buzz versus saying like, hey, you're going to get to watch four movies.
But you know what? What's crazy is that like, even if he just kept it at three, like to me, three is much more digestible than four.
Yeah. Well, four. Yeah.
I think the problem is they took it out of his hands and he knew he didn't have an ending. So he had to get ahead of that narrative and almost say like, there's more to come because what I'm showing you is going to clearly just end. And there's a lot to be left to be resolved sort of thing. This is a much bigger conversation about the serialization.
I didn't mean to go on a soapbox rant. No,
but what I found it to be really fascinating that we're about to transition into Joker, which is trying to do this originality inside of a franchise that we're talking about. Yeah. So, and is getting rejected.
Before we move to Joker, I was going to ask Gabe a quick question.
Go ahead. Yeah.
Did you didn't have the live element in your Megalopolis screening? Did you know? Can I tell the story of mine?
Sure. Yeah.
So really quickly, if you're unfamiliar with what I'm talking about, there's a moment in some screenings of Megalopolis where a live person is supposed to come in like a press conference and ask Adam Driver a question. And Adam Driver is supposed to sort of look at the person where the person is supposed to be standing. And it's like he's talking to him. And my rep. So it was a screening just for me. Here in Chicago,
I thought maybe you saw it at like TIFF or something.
No, it was literally just a private screening here in Chicago to prepare to have Francis, and my rep gave me a heads up like, dude, I got to do the thing. So we all have representatives of different studios who are sort of your middleman between yourself and the bigger movie studios. And this really cool guy here in Chicago, Pierce, I consider him a friend. He goes, just forgive me whenever I have to like get up in the middle of the movie. And so in the middle of this like crazy ass movie, I just hear this guy like shuffling downstairs and then he gets into position and like has like this, he unfolds this paper of things that he's supposed to say. And then he realizes that Adam's looking at a different part of the theater. So he was in the wrong spot. And all of a sudden I just hear, fuck. And then he like goes over to his spot and then starts.
Now, see, I'm upset I didn't get that.
What did you get? Is it factored into the movie now?
It's a press conference moment in the movie where Adam Driver is answering questions. And the idea is that someone in the audience is one of the people asking a question. And so.
Right. But I was curious what Gabe got since they're not doing the live.
I'm sorry. I misunderstood.
I mean, because your person didn't actually say it. They just sort of act out the question that's had, right, Jake? Like your rep.
Yes, correct. Correct.
So I think all of the difference is it's just the shot of him. There's no shot of who's asking the question.
Okay.
And the frame does come down to this, like if you picture, you know, the full frame, it comes down to like the bottom third, maybe in the middle, like a tiny little window of the scene, which is interesting. And again, I think that's a great example of what I think this movie does constantly, which is it can feel disjointed. It can feel like the actors aren't in the same movie, but I think it's just trying new ideas all the time. And I think that's just a interesting idea to infuse theater. There's so much of this movie that feels like a play, whether it's the way it's written, it's very Shakespearean and there's like soliloquies and things like that. And I mentioned, I'm trying to think of an example of like a Shakespearean character, Jake, maybe, you know, that Shia LaBeouf's character very much plays.
I don't have enough of a breadth of Shakespeare's work to be able to intelligently answer that question.
It was fascinating. I wish that what they would do is when you buy a ticket at random, when you get to the door, they go, okay, you have to do something. They pick an audience member to go run up every time. But yeah, the last thing I wanted to say is that my review of it is I think you should see it. Like that's all I can understand about it. I think you should see it.
I want to transition to Joker 2, fully adult, but I don't think we can do this without spoilers. Gabe, I don't know. Do you want to punch out? Do you want to?
Oh, you guys go ahead and take over. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, do you mind listening or?
I think I'll be okay.
You think okay, that's fine. It's really difficult to discuss this film and why it works or doesn't work without getting into specifics. So all I will say to you at the top, and then Jake, maybe you can just throw in something as well too, is I can't really recommend you go see this. Like, I don't think that it's, I think it's incredibly well made. I think it's really well acted. I don't think the movie has a reason to exist, and I'll explain in more detail in a second. So I have a hard time recommending it. Jake, do you think people should at least go see it or?
It's so funny because it's one of the movies in recent memory where I often talk about my newsroom, right? My newsroom of people who are casual moviegoers. Sure. I've gotten a lot of questions about this one, and I've basically had to tell them, like, listen, it's not a bad movie. It's not. It's I respectfully challenge anyone to walk out of that and say that it's bad.
Right. We have seen bad movies. That's not a bad movie.
I'm sorry. That's one of those things where, like, if you say that's a bad movie, you need to see more movies.
Sure.
However, I think there's a really solid chance you're not going to like it. And I think you're going to come out of there being disappointed.
Sure.
You know, and maybe because maybe some people don't appreciate other aspects of maybe the filmmaking process that we do, maybe then they might chalk it up to, oh, it's just bad.
Sure.
But it's not a bad, no, I would agree with you. It's not bad, but I wouldn't tell you to go see it.
Right. That's how I feel. All right. So spoiler talk. I am so proud of the fact that when Jake asked me, I got to see it earlier than he did by a couple of weeks. And when he asked me about it, my biggest takeaway was that this movie hates the first movie. I said, this movie really hates Joker.
My favorite part, whenever, because you and I were talking about it and you used that line whenever you were explaining it to me, and then you pause and you go, does that make any sense? And I go, no, it doesn't make any sense.
Yeah. Cause I understood how baffling it was. And then after you saw it, the first thing I asked you was, do you get what I mean? That it hates. And you were like, absolutely. But,
and then my taking it a step further was, I was like, oh, this is his Dune Messiah.
Yeah, exactly.
Which, do you know the looks I've been getting in my newsroom when people are like, how's Joker 2? And I go, it's his Dune Messiah.
Yeah. And they're like,
silence. A movie no one has seen yet.
Silence. Yeah.
So ultimately, what we're trying to say is Joker Folie à Deux feels like Todd Phillips got really mad at the way that people felt about Joker, that they in his mind, this is how I feel, that they had the wrong takeaways about Arthur, about the Joker, about mental health, about being a criminal, all of these aspects. So he made a movie that critiqued people who embraced the first movie. So this film largely deals with Arthur being on trial for the consequences of the things that he did in the first movie. So right off the bat, he's answering the question, which was left vague at the end of the first one, of did this stuff actually happen or was it kind of in his head? That was one of the unanswered questions. So clearly he killed the people on the subway. He shot De Niro's character in the face on live TV, and now he's in prison. And Todd Phillips went ahead and made an oppressive, in my mind, and just uncomfortable prison movie. You know, like you feel trapped by the film the way that Arthur does. And he's getting ready to stand trial. Catherine Keener is playing his attorney. She would like to put forward some sort of defense that there's a separation between Arthur and Joker, which a little bit is what the first movie was talking about, you know, was trying to paint the fact that they're two different personalities. And that's always been an interesting aspect of Joker. What is so baffling about this movie, or what I found to be really interesting until the movie shit on it was that when given the opportunity, Arthur chooses Arthur, right? Like he, at a very pivotal point, he's like, he doesn't embrace that argument in court. And he essentially says like, no, I'm not the Joker. Like that's not me sort of thing. And that to me was when it was Todd Phillips kind of rejecting how people felt about the first movie, you know, like they made a movie that should have just been called Arthur Fleck, really, right? Like it's more of a study of this individual. And then that's how I a little bit felt that the Gaga stuff was underserved, because her version of Harley is someone who's obsessed with the Joker personality, which I think is a good way to get into it. But when Arthur chooses Arthur, she gets lost in the story. Like that, by that point, the story kind of loses her. So I almost felt like we suffered through the torment of the first 1.5 movies to be told by the filmmaker, you're rooting for the wrong person, you know? Is that the right takeaway? Did you feel that at all? Or am I kind of lost on that island?
Well, I mean, I think it's to your point in that pivotal moment where Arthur basically says like, there is no Joker. Like yeah. I did these things and you know, there's this, you know, I'm going to use a Dune term, this Messiah that you're all worshiping.
Yeah.
Doesn't exist. And he's me. And I actually do think it's interesting that at that moment, Lady Gaga Harley kind of checks out. She's like, yeah. Oh, well, then, you know, and all of like the bros who are kind of following him check out. And I do feel like that's Todd Phillips being like, listen, if you were a part of that audience for the first movie that cheered when Arthur shot Murray in yeah. the face,
right,
you're reading it wrong.
Yeah.
Like you are not getting. And the reason I keep calling this like Dune Messiah is because Frank Herbert had to write Dune Messiah because people misinterpreted Paul Atreides as a hero.
Right.
And he basically went, you do not get what I'm trying to tell you. So here, let me write another book to really drive home my point. Yeah. And that's why I feel like this is kind of just sort of an epilogue that just drives home like, hey, if you happen to be now, for me, I didn't find that revelation as interesting because I didn't walk out of the first Joker seeing him as a hero.
Right.
So this big revelation, oh, he's not a hero, was not shocking to me. To me, it was I get who you're talking to, but who you're talking to ain't me.
So hero is the wrong word, I think. I think they more painted him as a symbol, right? Like hero means he's standing for something good. Symbol to me, like with Joker gives a bad element an excuse or a motivation for bad people to do bad things.
Yeah.
And I do think that there's an interesting element of both of these movies that he's being put on a pedestal by a criminal element, you know, right. And that they're showing up at the court to sort of champion him.
Yeah.
And that they get upset when he rejects that aspect. Right. But then what I think the cardinal sin that this movie commits is, why are you setting this in a Joker, Batman, DC world at all?
Yeah.
Like it has nothing ultimately to do with those central characters. In fact, goes out of its way to kind of reject any connection to those central characters. And the inclusion of Harvey Dent in this movie, who's the district attorney who is trying the case against Arthur, is in it just because you'd assume that's who Harvey Dent should be.
Even Todd Phillips said, I have no interest in Two-Face. Like it had to be. He's like, who else would the prosecutor in Gotham City be? It has to be. So he didn't include Harvey Dent because of the need to build a Batman lore. He did it because logistically it just made sense.
So then because of that, I ultimately believe that this second movie does nothing to help the first movie.
Like I would go a step further and say that the ending of this movie actually kind of makes me like the first one less.
And let me just say,
yes, please.
If the first movie was its own movie and you watched a guy get pushed around by the world enough, you know, that ultimately he decided he was going to embrace this figure that people were making him out to be. And then it had a esoteric ending where we could argue for years. Did it ever happen? Was it ever in his head? That thing got 11 Oscar nominations.
Yeah.
It earned Oscar.
And up until Joaquin. 2 months ago was the highest grossing R-rated film of all time.
Right. I just said, you shouldn't touch that. You know? Yeah,
leave it alone.
Leave now, it alone.
Because in my mind, I always, after the first movie ended, and I'll never forget us all being in that bar at the Four Seasons, sort of just breaking down this movie, me, you, and Kevin and Gabe.
Yeah.
And for me, it was less of a matter of, did it really happen? Because I thought, well, of course it really happened. My mind was, man, how do we get from that moment? Because the last image we get of him is him running rampant in Arkham, which is such a great image. Yeah. And so my mind goes to, damn, what happens between that moment and the moment he's going to come toe to toe with Batman? Because by nature of who he is and the city that this story takes place, he's going to meet Batman. He just has to. That's the reason this story happened. That's the reason we're even talking about this guy in the first place.
Right.
Because eventually that guy is going to meet Batman. And that was just such, I never wanted to see it, but it was so cool to imagine.
Sure. Right.
Now, what we've been taught is he never does because he's not the Joker.
Right. Exactly.
Because he is. And there was, I remember when the first movie came out that there were rumblings of, well, what if he's not the Joker?
Sure.
And what if he's the guy that is the symbol for the Joker down the road?
Sure.
And that was a fine theory, but I chose not to believe it because I wanted to choose. This is one of those things that's like, well, like it was answered for me. And I didn't really want that question answered, but it was answered. And now I don't like the ending. And in fact, the ending actually kind of, because now it's like, what am I going to do? I'm going to go back and rewatch the first movie about the guy who's not actually the Joker.
Right. It kind of does.
Now we have, instead of having one movie about the Joker, we have two movies about a guy who's not the Joker.
Yes. Right. That's exactly what we ended up with. We went through two movies to reach the conclusion that this guy we've been watching this entire time is not the Joker.
It reminds me of there's that great story. I think it was a buddy of mine went to go opening weekend of Friday Night Lights. And if you've ever seen Friday, and here's the deal: Friday Night Lights is based on a true story. You have to take it. You know, it's a great story. But it ends with, and I think it's a great ending. It ends with the team losing. In state, they lost by like a yard, the big game. And then there's the title cards of what ends up happening to all these guys. And the final title card is the team ends up next year one state. Okay. And a guy in the audience goes, why the hell didn't they make a movie about those guys? And so it's sort of like, if the end of this is the actual Joker, because you see the guy cutting the smile into his cheeks, it just makes me want. It makes me want to go, why the hell did you make that movie about that guy?
Two movies. Two movies. Why don't you make two movies about that guy, Todd Phillips? You made a movie called The Hangover, but it wasn't about the kids. None of these guys were hungover.
At the end of the movie, they start drinking.
It's a guy on another hotel room. Now, we have had this argument briefly between the two of us. I still don't even think, and this is for people who are deep in the weeds and have seen the movie, I don't even think that the guy who cuts his face at the end of the movie ends up becoming the Joker.
But
I think the argument of the movie, especially in a movie that takes the identity away from Arthur Fleck, is that you'll never really know who the Joker is. It's just always going to be a bigger symbol that gets passed to the next person, to the next person, to the next person.
Because
Todd Phillips doesn't care.
Because keep in mind, the events of this movie, even though it's been, 5 years since the first movie, the events only take place 2 years after.
Okay.
Still, Bruce is still very young.
Sure.
So by nature of the guy who cut his face is still maybe there's not as much of an age gap as there would have been with Joaquin, but there's still a pretty significant age gap between the guy who cut his face and the kid who will inevitably become Batman. Maybe. Right. Who the fuck knows? Maybe he won't.
I actually now hope we get a Joker 3.
This time we mean business.
This time with 100% more Joker.
But the funny thing is, I think Joaquin's amazing. I think
he's fantastic. Great. And that's why I refuse to say that this is a bad movie. The cinematography, I think, should be among conversation for Oscar consideration. It's one of the most beautiful films.
Yeah.
that's going to be projected onto a screen this year.
I think taking in some elements.
Joaquin, yes. Maybe like the luster is gone because of how shocking it was to see this performance 5 years ago.
Sure.
But Joaquin is just as good in this one as he was in the first one.
Yep.
I think Gaga's fine. I think she's a little underutilized. I just don't think she has as much to work with.
Yes. I don't think it's anything of her problem. Yeah. I think the script lets her down.
Yeah. I really dug the musical element for a bit. Yeah. And then it became very long in the tooth very fast. I would say through the attempted jail breakout.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I was like really into it. And then at that point I was like, okay, I understand.
Yeah.
I get it, but you don't have to keep doing it. And the fact that at the end of the day, half of the movie is a courtroom drama with the Joker. Like I just have no interest in that.
Yeah.
I have no interest in a courtroom drama with the Joker defending himself.
Well, because it didn't really go anywhere.
Yeah.
It's unfortunately. So, all right. Listen, call to action. Did you see Joker 2? Hopefully you did by the time we got to the end of this conversation.
Yeah. Sorry.
Head to the comments down below the YouTube video. Let us know your thoughts. Let us know. Give us your quick review of the film. Thoughts on Joaquin. Thoughts on Lady Gaga. Thoughts on whether the movie should have happened. Specifically, if you're going to put thoughts about the ending, please put some sort of spoiler warning. We don't want people to give away the things that happen in the end of this movie. But yeah, tough one to recommend, man. It's just a sad movie.
That's a bummer. Honestly, that was probably my most anticipated of the fall.
Yeah, well, I got you.
Now, just out of curiosity, for Conclave, which would you recommend first of today's two movies that we discussed?
I don't
know. Joker 2 or Megalopolis?
I don't know. I didn't see Megalopolis.
I'm asking Jake.
I would say Megalopolis just because... I'm not regretting the existence of Megalopolis. Like I'm genuinely happy Megalopolis existed. Here's what I say. I enjoyed watching Joker more.
Yeah.
And there was even a moment halfway through Joker where I leaned over and looked at Kevin and went, I'm digging this. I'm into it. It lost me in the back half. And so Joker is a more enjoyable movie, but if someone gave me $100 million to throw at one of their box office, I'm giving it back to
you. Were digging the folly. You didn't really care for the do.
Around the it lost me.
It became
folly. Do.
Follow us on social media at Jake's Takes, at Kevin McCarthy TV, at Sean_O'Connell, at Gabe Kovach, and the show is at Real Blend. As mentioned, we have a bunch of really fun interviews coming, so make sure you keep it here. Subscribe. Turn on your notifications, share the show with a friend, and until next week.
Why didn't they make a movie about that guy?
Night, bitch.
Guys, we're a third of the way there. Now we just need Lucas and Spielberg.
Yeah.
Well, De Palma?
Scorsese.
I'll throw De Palma in that.
We need Scorsese.
All right, so we're one fifth of the way
there. Yeah, we're not. We got a long way to go.